You are listening to a Ruth Millington Extreme Holidays podcast. Extreme stories from extraordinary destinations as told by intrepid world travellers. Presented by travel writer and adventure junkie Ruth Millington, survivor and heroine of the 2003 BAM earthquake in Iran.
Hi, and thanks for joining me yet again on another of my Extreme Holidays podcast. I'm Ruth Millington. We've had some wonderful feedback so far. Tandy from Hungary said, so interesting and very professional, such cool stories. Teresa from Nottingham said, enjoyed your podcast. Very professional, which can only be expected from a woman of your calibre. Thank you very much, Teresa. And then there's Jean from Sheffield, and she says, great stuff. So please do keep sending in your feedback. It really does help. My guest today is the remarkable Claudia Steckelhaus. Originally from Germany, Claudia has lived in Australia and South Africa before settling in London 15 years ago. After a career in investment banking, she's been hosting supper clubs, teaching cooking classes in the community, and running toiletries for the streets, which hands out basic toiletry packs to rough sleepers in London, and which she started up at the beginning of the pandemic. She's also a travel addict, having travelled extensively across Asia and parts of Africa. Recently, she's been to Ethiopia, Iceland, and completed a section of the Camino de Santiago pilgrimage in Spain. She's also worked in a safari resort in South Africa. Today, though, we will be discussing her extreme story of being in a horrific accident whilst on holiday in Namibia. So, without further ado, let's travel the world together. Claudia, welcome to the show. You're a big traveller. Why do you enjoy it so much?
Hi, Ruth. First of all, thank you for having me on your podcast. I don't know. Why do people like travelling? Why do I like travelling? Travelling is just an amazing thing. It's so nice to see different cultures, different people, different experiences, different weather. It's just also kind of nice to be on the move rather than stuck in one place.
So tell me about your extreme story. What were you doing in Namibia, in Africa?
That trip in Namibia, I booked it while I was still in investment banking, so I was really busy at the same time. I think I had bought a flat and did lots of renovations, so I was really busy, so I had no time to properly plan an independent trip, and kind of decided to go on a organized trip. I think it was just a 2 weeks trip, safari lodges around Namibia. I was always interested in Namibia, obviously. As being German, it's one of the few places we unfortunately colonized, but it's also therefore one of the few places where people speak German, which seems really unusual for us Germans to suddenly hear your own language in a different continent. Those days, my situation has slightly changed because, if people remember, there was a big financial crisis which hit the financial world in 2008, so I had just been made redundant at the end of the summer of that year. But I kind of thought, you know, I mean, the trip is paid for, the trip is booked, just let's go. Went on the trip. Obviously, like, there's lots of things I don't really like about organized trips, which is quite often that they are scripted, but also quite often the groups are not the most interesting people. So when I arrived in Windhoek, met my group in the first lodge, I was already thinking, oh my god, I don't want to say anything about age or the people who are much older, but anyway, I was probably about 25 years the youngest person. There was one other lady who was maybe like 10 years my senior or 7 years my senior, I can't remember now. So at least the two of us, we were like sharing a room. So first night, we were having one night in this first lodge. We were sitting there, had, you know, get to know the group. I was having quite a bit of wine with my roommate. yeah, the tour guide was with us as well. And yeah, we were just hanging about, having some wine. And then I think next morning was a relatively early start, as usual on these kind of things, because we were straight away leaving Windhoek. So we were going on our vehicle to drive to the first safari camp in some desert, which was kind of a converted minibus kind of thing. I mean, I think we were about 8 or 10 people, quite small, like a Sprinter maybe, or I mean, probably it had space for about 14 people, kind of this size. But the interesting bit was it had a canvas roof. So it was a vehicle which could have been used later on for game watching. So anyway, we were just driving. I don't even know. I think we had a break somewhere. So we must have been driving 2 hours or something. So we're getting off. I mean, you know, Namibia is a quite empty country. So we quite quickly left the tarmac roads and went on the dirt roads. And I kind of remember I was kind of like half sleeping, half reading a book, sitting next to the girl I was sharing my room with. The bus was driving and then was driving around a bend. And, you know, I wasn't really concentrating, but you could feel the bus was going there in the bend, and then it started like shaking a bit, and you got this feeling, okay, this was too fast. And it was kind of like clear to me after a moment that this bus is going to turn over, because, you know, there's a certain physics in that. So it starts moving a little bit, but at one stage you have reached a pivotal point and the whole thing actually did fall over.
What were the conditions like?
I mean, it was a typical kind of thing you expect the deserty country to be like. So it was hot, it was dirt track, there was hardly anyone, there was no traffic. I mean, it was just a dirt track, very dusty.
So when you sensed the vehicle was starting to turn, what happened then?
I mean, I just knew it would fall over. but that was the last thing I can remember, because what happened is, as I said, the vehicle fell over, and obviously it fell over quite fast. And as I mentioned before, there was a canvas roof on it. So what happened, because I was not sitting on the, so it kind of fell on my side, but obviously the other girl was sitting next to me. So in a way, she was by the window, and the window fell on the dirt track. But I was kind of thrown out of the vehicle over her, ended up on the road, and by falling out or kind of flying out, I landed on my head, and that knocked me out for a bit.
Was the vehicle going very fast at the time?
It wasn't going very fast, but it was definitely going too fast around the corner. So therefore, it lost traction, and it just the driver lost control over it, which probably would have been fine on a tarmac road, but on a dirt road, it was... For that corner, it was too fast. And this is why also the vehicle still had quite a bit of speed. And so when it fell over, it kept skidding, which unfortunately injured quite a few of the people who were like on that side where the glass was, because the glass shattered. And then people were like lying on the glass. Maybe the other people who were sitting next to them were on top of them.
So you're unconscious on the ground and you wake up. How did you feel at that exact moment when you came to?
That's, I don't know, people who have ever been unconscious or who have ever been, I think it's the same if you had like an operation and you're under full anaesthesia. I think the moment when you wake up is like a weird moment anyway. I mean, I had it before in different situations, and you just don't know what's going on, because somehow you kind of have something in your head, and then like it's almost like a dream, which is really real. And then you wake up, and like I woke up into because obviously I was unconscious, or I can't remember what happened. Maybe I wasn't even unconscious as such. So I woke up to me actually screaming, going on about like, oh, this is not good that this happened, because what I'm going to do, I just lost my job and now I'm on the ground in Namibia. So I was obviously slightly, my brain wasn't functioning properly.
What injuries did you sustain?
At that moment, no one knew. So at that moment, I didn't have any proper open wounds or anything. Obviously, I had some scratches on my elbow, on my knee and on my head, but it was nothing, nothing compared to other people's injuries. But like the other people, because what happened was the people who were really on the ground, they got injured, but the people who were sitting on the other side of the bus, they had no injuries at all. So we had about 4 or 5 people who had no injuries at all. And they were kind of saying that they were a bit worried about my head because I had been like screaming about for quite a while. So people kind of suggested I shouldn't move for a bit because that's normally was a head injury. I mean, I didn't have much pain at the moment, but I was just told you better don't move for a bit. We have a tour guide and a driver. And some of this, what I'm saying now, I can remember. Other stuff I just know because people told me. So the problem was neither the driver nor the guide were really in taking charge, or they didn't really know what to do. So they were trying to phone the head officers to do something, but they were not really hands-on with any first aid. So obviously, again, we're in the middle of some hot desert. People are bleeding. People really need first aid there. They need to get into the shade and things like that. So the kind of non-injured people, which were mainly the husbands of the wives who were like injured, and I'm talking these people are all like 70 plus, they were shocked as well.
Did they sustain any serious injuries?
Some of these people were really seriously bleeding, so they needed attention straight away. And then what happened, as I said, there's not much traffic, but we were lucky enough that a car came by and a car stopped. And we were even more lucky in that car was a nurse and a, like, I think, I can't, again, I think it was maybe 2 nurses or a nurse and a doctor even or something, but they were actually on holiday. They were like not, it was just a complete coincidence. So they stopped and they knew what to do. They kind of sorted the accident scene out for the moment, because they put the people into a shade. They had like the blankets, you know, and that I think the nurse actually even did some first aid on, I don't know if she did stitches, but at least she did something to the wounds. She might have cleaned some wounds and things like that. Again, I won't be able to say exactly how long, but it would have been at least 1 hour, 2 hours before an ambulance arrived, just because, you know, we could reach them, but the next hospital was just very far away. So it took a really long time before an ambulance arrived, and then the next question was, obviously, the ambulance had to then decide who goes on it, because I think it could maybe take 4 or 5 people in one go.
So there's only one ambulance that came?
Yeah, so I gather they just don't have that many ambulances or something. So they took the most seriously injured people who really needed first aid and stitches and wounds cleared. They took them first. I think they took their husbands with them as well. But I was left behind because, again, I was just told not to move. But I was then going on the second ambulance.
What was that journey like?
When I got in the ambulance, they put me on a drip, and I think that helped also to kind of regain my brain abilities. So yeah, it was a bit weird because obviously this ambulance was still driving on a dirt track. And again, like, you had this a little bit, because on a dirt track, you know, everything is moving and shaking a bit. So for a bit, I had this kind of fear, you know, that this ambulance is going to fall over as well very soon. But it didn't. But what did happen is the ambulance suddenly stopped. And we were like, why is the ambulance stopping? And it turned out it ran out of petrol. So yeah, I mean, again, luckily it was kind of me on it, and maybe there must have been 1 or 2 other people, but none of the really people who needed urgent attention, because we just had to wait then for obviously a car to bring us some petrol.
And how long did that take?
It's probably half an hour or something like that. Yeah, I think the whole accident happened, as I said, maybe around lunchtime. And by now, it was already getting dark, I would say. And then when we arrived in the first hospital, it was already dark.
Ruth Millington's Extreme Holidays Podcasts. Life-changing stories and adventures from the world's intrepid holidaymakers and travellers.
When you were taken to the medical centre, the hospital,
what
was it like, and did it concern you at all in terms of facilities available?
It was obviously a little country, it was not a main hospital, it was just a little medical centre, as you rightly almost said. They did have x-ray machines, And obviously they had, I guess there were doctors there as well as nurses. So they did all the first aid what they had to do. But like with me, they still didn't really know what to do with me. So they put me in an x-ray, but what is an x-ray going to do? It wasn't the best experience because I obviously after I kind of fell out, I was bruised everywhere. And then I remember I was on this stretcher, of course, but then this course I had to go to this x-ray. They were putting me from one stretcher into another stretcher to get me into the x-ray thingy. And it was all a bit like painful. And obviously you have to remember around me is all these other people who, you know, one woman was seriously, at the end she lost an eye. So, I mean, she was really in lots of pain and in lots of worry. And, I mean, she was screaming about. And at the same time, we also had to sort out the practical things, because so far I think no one had properly reached the company and the organizer. So that meant the hospital obviously wanted payment. So obviously we had insurance and people were starting calling their insurances, but not everywhere had all their like details together. So people had to kind of get credit cards out to pay them. So it was all this kind of weird thing happening as well, which is always a bit disconcerting if you just want to have people to be treated. And then first you have to sort out the money thing. And of course, people are all in shock and they don't know really where their stuff is. I mean, I kind of knew where my stuff was, even although I didn't have much with me, but I could tell them, there's my purse, get this out. Obviously, it didn't feel like a hospital in Europe or anything. It was all a bit like ramshackle and a bit like basic. But they obviously decided that we had to leave that hospital, especially like I had to definitely, and then two of the other people definitely. So then at the end, they decided obviously to take all of us to Windhoek on the same night.
How did you feel being on your own?
Obviously, I was lucky that I had my paperwork for my insurance, because that would have always been a bit tricky if you're on your own, and then who would actually sort this out for you? I don't know. But otherwise, I didn't mind that much, because if you're with someone, then you kind of have to worry about the other person as well, or the other person might worry about you. So at least for this, I was just, it was my thing. I didn't have to worry about other people or things like that. So I wasn't too worried. Or I wasn't feeling lonely, or I wasn't feeling like lost.
So you were put in a hotel in Windhoek. What happened then?
No, there was one step before. Because we went back to Windhoek Hospital. There was a CT scan done and they figured out they had a cracked vertebrae, which is a bit shocking, because if it would have cracked completely, that would have meant I would have been paralysed from kind of the neck onwards. But I had never really thought about this. I just thought I have a bit of a, you know, a bit of a pain, but that I was like scruffing by being paralysed was something I didn't really expect. I had to stay in the hospital for a bit longer. It's obviously nothing much they can do with a cracked vertebrae, they said, but I had to get like a proper neck brace. What they had in stock kind of was just like a non-proper one. So they had to get one from Johannesburg. So that took 1 or 2 days. So for 1 or 2 days, I had to kind of be in that hospital and lie in beds without moving. So people came around, they had to kind of feed me and things like that. So it wasn't like the nicest experience. But again, that was really nice to have that in Namibia, where at least there's no shortage of staff. So there were a lot of nurses and they were really caring and they were really nice. And then in the meantime, people came around from the company, the organizer in Europe, but as well from the subcontract, because the Namibia trip was subcontracted from a South African company. So people came over and saw us in hospital. And there was a guy who was the owner of that South African company. So he came by and he was trying to help us. So I think he got me a laptop and some movies to watch. So he came by quite often to, you know, make sure that things were a bit nicer for us. But yeah, for me, everything was actually fine as soon as the brace arrived, because my pain was almost gone, because it was just a few bruises here and there, so that was gone by then. So once I had the brace, I was allowed to walk about. So like, there was no reason for me to stay in the hospital any longer. Moved to a nice hotel around the corner. There was a couple of people, like the husbands who were not ill, plus like there was some guy from some insurance company who actually looked at the accident, and then there was a guy from the South African owner of the company. He was actually a quite attractive bloke. So
what happened then?
You know, you must make the best of every situation.
Do you think this was part of being in shock?
No, that's just me. I always make the best of every situation. Nothing is bad. So, like, even in hindsight now, like, when people ask me, my God, this accident was so bad. I mean, obviously, again, luckily, I mean, I shouldn't joke too much because I could have been paralyzed, which obviously would have then not be funny anymore. But what happened to me, I was lucky enough to not. I mean, I had pain for beds, but otherwise, and obviously I didn't have a trip through Namibia, but otherwise, you know, I made the best out of it.
So what happened when you returned to London?
First of all, like, I kept in touch with my South African lover, which was actually quite nice. So in a sense that, I mean, in those days we didn't have WhatsApp and stuff, so it was emails, more or less, and I didn't even have a proper phone where you could send emails with. So it was more like, quite often, like in the evening, we would have a chat, an email chat, which was quite nice because, as I mentioned, I just had lost my job and I was still injured. And obviously that was someone we could talk about that accident and about what was going on, also with the other people. So it was just nice to have someone to chat. It gave you a little bit of a structure in your life, because what also had happened is I went to a doctor here, to have it all checked, and they sent me to hospital here, and I had another CT scan. The doctor here, again, luckily I was still privately insured, therefore it was all quite quick. He said that there were some nerves trapped in between my vertebrae, and he said I need surgery on it. And straight away, because if you wait too long, then the nerve is damaged and things like that. Which, that was probably like a bigger shock than the other way, because for me, the accident was over. I was just wearing a brace for a little bit. But now it was like coming up Christmas, and now I have to have surgery where, like, they put some screws in my spine.
Back to the accident and the driver. Why do you think the driver lost control?
He was driving too fast. And I mean, again, this was obviously most of the people we were all suing the company, so this was all discussed in court, and there were obviously lots of insurance companies, and they were trying to figure out how this accident happened. But generally, I don't think there was any other reasons. There was no like alcohol or anything involved or anything. It was just the driver just drove too fast around a corner.
You spoke about not enjoying going on organised trips, and when you arrived in Namibia, you had this sort of feeling of dread about joining the trip. Do you think there were signs telling you not to go?
I don't generally believe in this kind of like signs happening, so no, I don't think so. And as I said, in hindsight, it was like a good thing. We got settlements. Was kind of helpful because I had mentioned I had bought a flat, I had done renovations, so I was kind of running out of savings. So this kind of money was kind of a nice thing to have as like a backup, as a savings, so which allowed me to do things like, as you said earlier, I'm just running supper clubs now, I do all various different things, but I haven't really, I mean, I have for a little bit, but not over the last couple of years done much proper structured finance work again.
Many people would have been put off travelling again, but here's you having an affair with the subcontractor, you're getting on with your life, and since then you've done multiple long trips. What do you think it says about you as a person?
I would just say it says I'm not easily fazed by anything. I mean, even now I think, and to be honest, this is the second bus accident I had before. I had a bus accident in Ecuador once. I kind of think, I mean, what is the likelihood of having another accident? The more you had in the past, the less you're probably going to have in the future. And also, it's always like stories to tell. After like my injury had more or less healed away, I still couldn't find a job because of the financial crisis. I rented my flat out properly, and I went off to Thailand for a month, and then I was working in a lodge in South Africa for a while, and then when that finished, I went back to Namibia. And again, like, first day in Namibia, we kind of drove over. It was, again, an organized trip, but a completely different one. But, yeah, we were driving over from South Africa, from downtown Cape Town, into Namibia, going to the Orange River to do some canoeing. And the first thing happens on the first day in Namibia, obviously, my canoe capsized. I got this massive cut over my eye, which I didn't go to hospital, I didn't need stitches, but again we had a nurse on the trip, I think, and she could kind of glue it together. But I still kind of didn't turn back, and so instead I go back into South Africa now. I stayed another 2 weeks in Namibia, and nothing more happened to me. So,
well, it sounds like you're very much of a go-getter and you're not put off by stuff like this, so bravo to you. Tell me a little bit more about your supper clubs and also the charity work that you do.
Supper club, one thing I've been doing now for almost 10 years, is almost shortly after that incident. I always liked entertaining, I always liked cooking. As I said, I just had bought a nice flat and did lots of renovations, so I had the nice space. And supper clubs became a thing about 10 years ago in London. So I just started doing that, and I'm still really busy mainly doing private parties. So people just come to my house for hen parties, for birthdays, for Christmas parties, for corporate networking events, or anything else they want. And I provide them with the space and quite nice food.
And what about your charity work?
I've never really been much of a volunteer or anything. That was always something which kind of started last year with the pandemic and the lockdown. So I was helping out in various charities last year and getting kind of in contact with lots of homeless people and with the problem of rough sleeping, I think. And especially last year in the first lockdown, there was obviously no facilities around. And I was just thinking, you know, these people have no access to showers, to toilets, not even. So I started a fundraiser to get kind of emergency money to buy mainly wet wipes and things like that, and handed them out to rough sleepers in London, which I did all of last summer until the lockdowns kind of finished. But now we are doing a one or two monthly handout at a certain spot where another charity is giving out food, because there's still so much needs, because we have so many. I mean, where we're doing it now is not far from where I live, in the middle of Shoreditch. Every Wednesday you have like 200 people queuing for food.
You've come from an investment banking world where, you know, it's a very much the rat race, there's a lot of money involved, and your life has kind of moved on to the point where you, since leaving that, you've been able to do more travel and get involved in more charity work. Do you think travel has shown you a side to the world which perhaps when you were in investment banking, you didn't see as much or chose not to see as much?
I mean, I've travelled while I was in investment banking as well. So I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. But definitely, like last year's events did. Because, I mean, travel is always even a bit different. Of course, you see, if you go to different countries, you see lots of poverty and lots of problems. But they're still there and different. They're not here. But, like, with last year's events and getting involved into lots of projects in London, then I kind of started to... I mean, I kind of knew before, but if you see it, then it really starts to sink in, like, that there's lots of problems here, just on your doorstep, and that in a way, yeah, we can be quite lucky that we can live the way and we can talk about travel, because I think there's lots of people who, and then that's their last worry if they can travel somewhere, because they seriously have to look for food rather than for airplane tickets.
Ruth Millington's Extreme Holidays Podcasts. Life-changing stories and adventures from the world's intrepid holidaymakers and travellers.
Okay, now we come to the quickfire question round, where I ask my guests a set of questions about their travel choices. Claudia, are you ready?
Oh my God, let's see what's coming up now.
Mountains or oceans?
Oceans.
Long haul or short haul?
Long haul.
Favourite place?
Oh, that's impossible to say. No, you have to ask favourite place in each country or something. let's say Rome.
What's the worst place?
Redcar.
Apart from the clothes on your back, what is the one thing you always take with you whilst on holidays or your travels?
Camera.
Where would you go back to?
Most places. Ethiopia.
Travelling solo with friends or family?
Ideally with friends. And then solo.
What's the longest period of time you have travelled for?
It's actually not that long. As in proper travel, I would say that was 3 months.
If there is one thing you could change about travelling, what would it be?
At the moment, get rid of COVID testing.
Claudia, thank you so much for being on the show. Amazing story that you have here, and I take my hat off to you for being so brave and also sharing that experience with us. Thank you very much. On the attached notes to this podcast, there is a link to Claudia's Supper Club and also links to her charity work. Please do check those out. And to all those listening in, this is the end of today's show. Thank you so much for joining me on my Extreme Holidays podcast. If you're enjoying this podcast, then it would be wonderful if you could leave a rating or a review on your podcast app. It really helps as it allows other people to discover this podcast. To find out who's joining me on the next episode, come and follow me on Instagram. I'm at Ruth Millington Author. You can also find me on Twitter at RuthMillington1. I'll be back next episode with more life-changing and adventure travel stories. To hear future episodes as soon as they're released, don't forget to hit the follow or subscribe button. And thanks for listening.
You have been listening to a Ruth Millington Extreme Holidays podcast. Extreme stories from extraordinary destinations as told by intrepid world travelers. Find out more at ruthmillingtonauthor.com or search online using Ruth Millington Extreme Holidays.
Ruth Millington's Extreme Holidays podcast is sponsored by HelpYouFind.me, a secure yet simple way to share private data for use in emergency situations that is end-to-end, encrypted and accessible only by you and the people you choose to share it with. Perfect for the extreme traveller. Find out more at HelpYouFind.me/Extreme10 and get a 10% discount when you sign up. Details are also in the show notes.